and that's exciting. Like I love a challenge, and so that was sort
Clearly.
of the end.
If there's one thing I've taken away from today, it is that Will Arbery loves a challenge.
I do. What can I say? Yeah.
Hi, folks. This week on Bus Ride Talks, I speak with playwright and Pulitzer Prize finalist Will Arbery. We talk Heroes of the Fourth Turning, get into the politics of both play and real life, his work at truth-telling through plays, and the many places and people that got him to where he is today. Let's get to it.
Cool. So, hi, Will. How are you today?
I'm doing well. How are you, Davinia?
I'm doing well. It is so exciting to get to talk with you. And, you know, we're going to get into your work and little things like that. But I think one of the things that I'm most excited about as I was looking at this is, like, I don't even know where to begin when we talk about your work, right? There's so many things. You have so many different theater awards and playwriting awards and so many different things that you've been able to do in your craft. You're a Pulitzer Prize finalist. And I think for the sake of being able, because I really want to get into the breadth of your work and I don't want to stick on just one thing, I do think I want to start there with Heroes of the Fourth Turning and sort of how it ended up in the stratosphere that it did. So can you tell us a little bit about that play? I have a synopsis pulled up, so I can either read the synopsis or if you want to give us a rundown, I'm down for either one.
Is it the synopsis from the Playwrights Horizons website?
It is that one.
I mean, you can read that one. It's a pretty good...
I would love to read that one. It's really good. It has a lovely mood to it. It's nearing midnight in Wyoming, it says, where four young conservatives have gathered at a backyard after party. They've returned home to toast their mentor, Gina, newly inducted as president of a tiny Catholic college. But as their reunion spirals into spiritual chaos and clashing generational politics, it becomes less a celebration than a vicious fight to be understood. On a chilly night in the middle of America, Will Arbery's haunting play offers grace and disarming clarity, speaking to the heart of a country at war with itself. And absolutely emphasis on grace and disarming clarity, because it really is, it's a piece that for me at least, it like really gets into your bones. And I don't think I'm the first person to say that either.
Yeah,
what was it like writing that? Because I think I was there. So actually, I met you at Playwrights Horizons when I was there as a literary fellow. And I was like on my way out as soon as that rehearsal process started. So I didn't get to see its development. But I know that that production at Playwrights was certainly not the start of this play. You'd been working on it for a while. You'd brought it to us as a reading too before that. So how did you end up like forming it to where it got to today?
I started it, I actually started it shortly before the election of 2016. You know, as you probably remember, I mean, even before Trump won and how polarized and divisive and terrible things got after that, it was already feeling that way. Even just the fact that he got the nomination, like the country was already sort of in turmoil. So it was already sort of like on my mind, the question of sort of like, who are we as a country? Who could, you know, how is this possible? How could anyone possibly support him? And coming from a very Catholic conservative background, I knew that there were people who most likely would vote for him, despite a great amount of like conflict in their heart. And you know, I was just like, I was just deeply curious in deeply curious about those people who I know quite well, and just learning more about that and exploring that. And so I started actually started with the character of Teresa in that monologue she has about the scandal of the particular. That's sort of, that was my entry point to this. And then and that was sort of like a short piece that I did. And then I did another short piece that explored the character of Emily. That's where I came up with Emily and Kevin and Justin. And both of those were written before the election and sort of assuming that Hillary was going to win. I was just sort of more interested in what it was like to cast that vote or sort of like see, you know, like, you know, that the sort of like, melancholy that I assumed, cause I thought Hillary was going to win too. And so I assumed that there'd be this melancholy in conservative circles about like this, you know, progressive agenda that was going to be, that was going to like eventually like come for their tabernacle, which is like, you know, like how I thought of it, like come for their faith or whatever, you know? And, and then Trump won. And then I was like, oh wow. I really got
this is different.
Yeah. I got to keep going into this and exploring more of this and make it into a full length. I just felt very, very called, to do that after he won. It felt like very clear that that was what I needed to do. And, I didn't really want to because it's different. I'd never really written about politics or anything. And I wasn't super well versed in politics or even like the education at the school, like where my parents teach. Like I had gone to Kenyon College instead of one of these Catholic Great Books programs that they had really wanted me to go to, and that all of my sisters went to as well. And so, so it required a lot of like circling back into this world that I had left. And I was in Youngblood at EST at the time, and I just used that writing group as a place to keep bringing in drafts and do early readings of it. And and so the development of it was, you know, from early 2017, I started writing in January 2017. And for a while, I just thought no one would ever produce this. It felt bad to write it. It was like... It was like really, it was really difficult, you know, because I was very clear in my mission to not have there be any liberal characters in the play, and to give the audience access to conversations that are, you know, sort of like in a like quote unquote safe space for like these conservative ideas, like.
Yeah.
That you can really parse out the differences and the viewpoints and really hear what they actually say to each other when there's not, you know, someone, when there's not a liberal there who's going to like get offended and storm out of the room, you know? So like it's this like space for access, but that, you know, there was a lot of discomfort that I had to push through. It wasn't just like a gleeful sort of like, oh,
writing experience.
Yeah, it was hard. And, you know, and then eventually got some more reading at the Vineyard, and then a week of development at the Cape Cod Theater Project, which is when I started working with Danya and working with Danya during that week, was when I really started to finally actually really believe in the play, because she really believed in it. And she also just brought it to life in a really full, exciting way.
Danya Tamer, for those who don't know, Danya Tamer was the director on the like actual production at Playwrights Horizon, and is just in general a really amazing director who I think, you're telling us now, worked with for a long time on this project and really stuck with you and with the piece for a while.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, she's amazing. And two of our cast members were actually in the Cod reading, Zoe Winters and Jeb Krieger, who played Teresa and Justin. And so the play really started to find itself during that week. And then we got back to New York and we felt all this like excitement about it. And so we emailed Adam, and we were based at Adam Greenfield at Playwrights Horizons. And we're basically like, can we show you guys this play with this cast that we just worked with? And I did a bunch of changes on it, like really crucial changes, like sort of defining moments in the play I discovered during that week. And so, yeah, we got together in a little room at Playwrights Horizons and heard it out loud, a very informal little group. Were you there for that?
I was, yeah. I read your stage directions, actually. And it really, it came together really quickly, which is why there wasn't someone there to do stage directions.
Yeah.
And they were just like, our fellow can do it. And I was like, I can. Okay, I can. That's actually really interesting to hear, because I know like Danya had flown in from like somewhere else and was just about to fly out to another place. You were in the middle of doing something. So knowing that you came from one workshop to another gives that a little bit more context, because I know in like the department, it was just like something we threw together really fast. We were like, okay, what floor is available? Where's like where can we throw this together? And then you all were there. And it was a really good reading. It was the first time I had actually read, like, heard the piece. I hadn't read it yet, and I didn't know what it was going into it. So if I can get into like what my experience was, is that cool? Yeah, it was actually, I think it makes sense, and I feel like I already knew that like this was definitely a hard piece for you to write, like really like it's like gritty to kind of get into. That might not be the right word, but that feels like the right word right now. And for me, hearing it in that room for the first time, I remember it was really like it's kind of a terrifying play. It can be really scary depending on like what your perspective is. And you're right exactly in that. I think what's unique about this play and what really grabbed people about it is that you are listening to, it's four of the students, and then the principal makes five, right? You're really listening to a variety of conservative perspectives, and it's not just, they're not generalized at all, right? Like there's a real spectrum, and that Teresa kind of has this very like vicious, bold standout perspective, but she's also a very modern woman. Like she's in New York, she's a businesswoman, and her politics reflect that even as she is extremely conservative. And then there's Emily, who is like, you know, she has a conservative background, but she is very compassionate in her thoughts and like in her beliefs and how she's supposed to manage them. Kevin is like a little bit lost, and he's like, well, I was raised in this, I was educated in this, but like, what does any of it mean, and how does it reflect upon me as a human, and how am I supposed to reflect that back to other people? And Justin's kind of spending his time. Justin, I think, and I don't know how you would feel about it, but for me, Justin always has felt interestingly very aligned with Teresa in that he's a much quieter soul and like much, you know, he just holds a lot of himself together as like this very like calming presence, and yet he is just as ready for battle as like Teresa is, just a very different fight, but very much a fight still. And then the principal came in with like very, you know, she's older, she is the mom to one of the students in the group, and I think she came in with a perspective that really terrifies me the most, where it's conservatism that's like wrapped up in manners, wrapped up in like kindness and like, you know, the like political manners of like playing the system itself versus just like playing beliefs. And the being able to see all of that as like, as a woman of color, you know, all of this exists, but it's like, oh, this is really, it just felt very real. It felt very much like, I know that this exists. I know that there are people who think that way. And like, that's why my life is the way that it is. That's why a lot of systems are the way that they are. But to see the inside view of like how they would speak to each other, how a conversation unfolds with those very beliefs was like, it just got into my bones. It was like, oh my God, I don't know. It's so terrifying. It's so much to experience.
Definitely.
But
I
it's
mean,
really, yeah, go ahead.
no, you go ahead.
No, it's just like, it was terrifying. It took me a while to like really, I had to sit with that. I think I had to like take some space after the end of the reading and just be like, oh my God, this is like, this could exist. This is real. And like, it's very, I think you're, one of the things that came out in reviews, and I think one of the things that you kind of hinted at, is that like this is not what we usually think of theater is. Like we think of theater as like a very liberal art form anyway, and it is kind of a very liberal art form. So something like this, even as like a concept, doesn't really exist in theater spaces, and yet like this is the right thing, right? Like it can take up a theater space, and it should be a conversation because it matters. I don't know. That feels like such a didactic way to put it. I don't love that. I don't love that at all. But it's like it's important. It's a perspective, and the way that you crafted it and the way that you express it, because there's also elements of horror like in that. I think one of the most terrifying things is that like generator sound, quote unquote, that we end up finding is not the generator sound at all. We have no idea what that sound is. And Emily's like monologue at the end, where she kind of becomes a whole other person. There's just these little elements of like horror that slip in there that kind of show the like, it's like the undercurrent of the whole thing is that terror, right? Of like what all of this could mean. And that's worth putting on, even if it is terrifying.
No, definitely. And part of what was so uncomfortable for me about writing it, and part of why I thought no one would ever want to put it on, is because is because I knew deep in my bones that like I did not want to give the audience, you know, especially the sort of typical New York audience, the sort of liberal audience, any reason to congratulate themselves.
Like, yeah.
I didn't want this to be like, you know, the sort of standard like MO for like theater programming is like, oh, now we're going to do a play about this experience and everyone mm-hmm. can sort of walk away having spent time with that experience and feel a little bit better about having, you know, considered that, you know, such and such perspective or plight.
Yeah.
Or and it was like, I don't want this to slot into that category because that's just not at all what I'm it's such an oversimplification of what I think like a lot of us as artists are actually trying to do, which is to have a more lasting effect on people's imaginations and the way that they see the world. And if you're just walking away being like, oh, you know, I never thought about, you know, those types of people that way. That's mm-hmm. just enough, you know, it has to go deeper. It has to get in deeper because we are all sharing this planet together. And like, I don't know. I just knew that I really didn't want to like tie it up in a bow or resolve it and that the way not to do that was to not assert my own views into the play, to really try to remove myself as much as possible and not make the audience feel better. Because so much of what I think is going on, like, and why like a lot of these plays don't hit as hard is because mm-hmm. the audience knows that the author has sort of worked in sort of ways to protect themselves from criticism.
Yeah.
And like and ways to like if they're writing about someone unsavory, they've worked in ways to distinguish themselves from that character. And I was trying to mm-hmm. remove as much of that as possible so that the audience walked away, hopefully with part of the discomfort was not knowing where the author stood on any of this stuff. Like, which is like a really, really scary thing to do, but something
yeah.
that felt like was really essential. Especially, you know, like I don't know, like I would argue that there's a lot of straight white men in particular who go out of their way to protect themselves from that sort of criticism,
oh, for sure.
distinguish themselves from that. And I had to sort of knowingly like, I don't know, blur the lines and just be like, maybe I had to let the audience think that maybe I was this, because mm-hmm. in a lot of ways I am, like it's where I come from and it is how whiteness in America operates, or at least one corner of it, one part of it.
Right.
And like and blurring tearing down those walls and letting myself be seen that way was a very scary thing to do, but like a very important one, I think. I think created that disorientation in the audience because suddenly they feel those walls coming down in themselves too. And what I
right.
didn't Yeah, and like what I didn't know and what I was afraid of was like I didn't want to, you know, I wasn't afraid to create that discomfort in the sort of older white New York audience, but I didn't necessarily know how it was going to land with people of color or queer people, you know, like
yeah.
there was like a sort of alienation that I didn't want to happen. I wanted like and so I just had to like hope it was like an act of faith that like that people would see that it was just telling the truth and that was an important thing. And that like,
no, yeah.
Yes. Yeah, go ahead.
I truly had that question too. Like that was really one of my questions. It was just like, how do we take care of our audience that isn't just like older and white? Because it feels like truth. And I really, what you did is a terrifying thing. What you did is an absolutely terrifying thing, to just like let yourself be ambiguous, because there is an aspect of writing. And I think it is featured in playwriting a lot, to like save oneself when you do write unsavory things, or when you dig deep into something that is like, I think at least in the liberal theater world and in like the political theater world, seen as like a taboo thing, or like, you know, we don't abide by that belief. You know, there's like this overarching, sometimes false sense of justice. I don't want to get into that, but like false sense of justice and equity in theater of like we don't go to these places. That just is a bubble in some ways. And like not only did this play exist outside of that, but you also had to let yourself live outside of that. And that's probably a really terrifying thing to do because you don't know what the reviews are going to be by the end of that when people don't know. You don't know what they're going to write about you.
Totally, exactly. It was pretty scary because like it did feel sort of like I had staked it all on this. Like if I like I don't know, like if it had gone poorly or if I hadn't been thoughtful enough about how it, like it was like I had to simultaneously be extremely bold and take this tremendous risk and also calibrate it perfectly and delicately, you know, and just be extremely thoughtful about every word and every line, you know, and then also sort of like, you know, like once like people wanted to start like interviewing me and shit, like I was like, oh God, like I remember like the first big interview I had was with the New York Times, and then there were
Oh,
like a bunch
snap.
after that, but that was like the big first one, and I realized during that interview, like, oh, of course, people are gonna want to know what I actually think about all of this. Like, they like the scoop, sort of like, is this a conservative? Like, did Playwrights Horizons produce like a conservative writer? And I was like, oh, like I have this choice in this moment to either be like, no, I'm not, I'm not, I'm not, or I can just sort of live in this ambiguity and let people, because then what that does is it gives every audience member like complete sort of autonomy over their experience of the play. Like they can walk away and they can wrestle with it on their own terms and have conversations with their friends and like and figure it out together without it being like handed to them.
To
Anyway, so yeah, that was a very scary thing to do, very, very stressful.
Jake, I see you. You're unmuted. Join us.
No, this is really like interesting to listen to your perspective on this, because I never got the chance to experience Heroes. I've only ever heard from either Davinia or other friends of mine that did get to see it, or you know, this, that, and the other.
I actually only saw it digitally too, because I didn't get back
And
to New York.
I missed it. But so again, in trying not to take the angle of this podcast to real life political,
We go where we go.
over the course of the pandemic, I've been getting really into I've been following this reporter or journalist named Robert Evans, who's based out of Portland, and he's a leftist journalist, and he'd been covering a lot of the George Floyd uprising. And something that he's been talking about a lot recently is he came from an incredibly conservative background and carried that with him until he was a combat journalist and went and saw what was happening in the Middle East. And one of the things that he's trying to do now, which changed a lot of my perspective recently, was illuminating, I think, in the same way that you were approaching, and sort of this candidness of like the reality of what a lot of these people think, that edge on this line, and the nuance that can be there. And for him, it was less of like taking the stance of like whether or not this sort of conservative placement is inherently good or bad, but more so about what's there and how to approach it in hopes of change. And that's been something on my mind a lot recently, especially with the snowstorm that hit Texas, and seeing a lot of discourse about it being like they voted red, so it's like was somehow deserved, or just like things like that. It was like just terrible, and that's been some that specific thing has been really on my mind, and I've been really vocal about whether it's sort of the nuance there to better understand it, to reach out and influence change, or just understanding the variation that there is within the South and the Midwest. And I not knowing really much about Heroes, it's really interesting seeing that this has been something on your mind as well for a lot longer. And yeah, I just it's strangely it's interesting to see how pieces like this continue their relevance.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it seems to me that one of the most unproductive things we could possibly do as a citizen of this country is to assume that the other side is stupid, basically. Mm-hmm. I think that just doesn't help at all, because they're not. I mean, they're just quite simply not. Like, they might occasionally do things that are stupid or have views that are stupid, but so do we. And you know, it just is so much more productive, I think, to make the effort to learn what they actually think and why they think it. And more than fixating on, you know, the things that they believe that you might think of as evil or bad, which is also, you know, important to recognize and seek out. It's also really, really important to learn what their highest goods are, what people's goods are, what their idea of beauty is, what their love looks like. And it's a very unpopular thing to say. It's a tricky thing to say too, because sometimes what that can sound like is like, you know, let's all meet in the middle, and that's not really what I'm saying. I think that that's a sort of like oversimplification, but I also do think that talking about love is a tricky thing to do, and people sort of tune out of it and think of it as a cliche, but it remains, in my opinion, the most radical possible thing that we can do with our time.
Oh, that's really brilliant to hear. And I think one of the things, you know, you said this earlier and it's sticking in my mind, is like, you didn't know how this would land with like queer people and people of color. And I had the same question, and I still do, you know, because it's one of those things, like, I don't know. I know how it landed with me as like both of those things, but you know, you don't know how it lands with like every audience member. But I do think the one like solace I think that I found in it, the one like place where I was able to like access this and feel not safe, and I don't think it's a bad thing that I didn't feel safe like while I'm experiencing this work. I don't think that's necessarily like a bad thing. And I think embracing that feeling is a fine thing to do. But one of the things that allowed me to like access what you were putting into this. Oh shit. I hate when I forget my thoughts. I don't know. There's just this feeling of truth. And I think you mentioned that word too, of like hearing in a different way these characters speak what is true to them in a way that like we're not usually allowed to hear, or that we're not really welcome to hearing, you know, in both of those ways. And I think there's something, you know, I certainly of course disagree with a lot of their truths and the way that they stand in them, but there's something of relief for me in knowing that like the things that I see are not just imagined in my head. Like, you know, this idea of like how people function and how people see these things while still being human, while still thinking as like, yeah, you know, Gina does, that like they're still well-mannered, they're still, you know, meeting in the middle, still like somehow in their own form of thinking. And probably Teresa thinks she's a reasonable person. They all like have their ways of thinking, they're reasonable people. And I found some solace, and I'm just like, this is just how you think, this is how you breathe, this is how you live, and like this is how it spreads out to like your corners of the world and to the people that you communicate with. And I'm not crazy for seeing that way. I'm not crazy for being able to pick up on the way that like their threads have like imbued other people and themselves too. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah, definitely. And I think, you know, part of that might be the sort of, sort of commonly heard anecdote from people of color that like, you know, all these white liberals were surprised when Trump won, but like they weren't.
Yeah.
You know, that I think it's a little bit of that too, where it's like, thank goodness someone is actually talking about it, because it's I just think, again, it goes back to the stupid thing. Like, it's such a tendency for white liberals to distinguish themselves from the part of America by being like, oh, those are just all the stupid people. Like, just the idiots, you know, the sort of, like, evangelical idiots who just, like, don't know anything and just do what the televangelist tells them to or whatever. And that is just so wrong. And so I think, like, part of it, you know, there can be a real tendency among white liberal America to assume that they have a sort of monopoly on, like, articulation and brilliance, like, and education and all of these things. And it's just it's very wrong. And I think, like, hearing people speak these, like, differing viewpoints using language that's recognizable to them, I think is a very, again, a disconcerting experience, because it sort of breaks down those walls in between them and sort of makes them realize how close they actually are, could be to that. And how, just, you know, how every white person benefits from the system that was set in place by people who really believe in, you know, like, we're beneficiaries of that worldview. We just are. It was set up to serve us, and this is sort of how this is, you know, and that's really what, you know, conservatism is just sort of like, let's keep it the way that it was before. Like, what was wrong with that, you know? And part of what's so disconcerting about someone like Teresa, I think, is that she's this character who, yeah, she lives in New York. She, you know, watches all the shows. She knows all the memes. She's on Twitter. Like, she, and she also, like, has this sort of very recognizable absolutism that is, like, recognizable. And we've been talking about a lot about, like, older white liberals, but, like younger people today are very absolutist in their thinking, and very sort of, like, you know, like, that side is out to get us. With, like, there's, like, no room for nuance anymore. That's bad. This is good. You're either with us or you're not. And that's 100% Teresa's way of thinking and talking. You know, she thinks that there's a war coming, and she wants people to stop being wishy-washy and weak and, like, realize which side they're on and get ready to fight. and like that, I mean, like, you know, that's a kind of thinking that is extremely, I mean, especially in the year after the play opened, you know, last year, it was filled with that kind of rhetoric everywhere. It was everywhere. So I think that's another thing that's, like, I got emails from people who like, young people, queer people, people of color, like, multiple emails from people who said that they felt seen by the character of Teresa in a way that was, like, disturbing and revelatory for them. Never seen themselves represented before, like a young gay man who was like, I go to these shows where that's supposed to be about me, and I never feel like it's about me. And then I saw your play, and I was like, that's me. Oh my God. And then he, like, you know, like, called his grandma who had voted for Trump, and he hadn't, you know, talked to her in like 3 years. And, like, he talked to her again, and I mean, I don't even know what to do with that. I'm just like, okay, wow. Like, that was certainly not, like, that wasn't, like, I'm going to write a play where that, like, hopefully that thing happens. Like, I wasn't trying to, like, you know, be, like, healing or anything like that. Or I certainly wasn't trying to make Teresa, like, a parallel to, like, young progressives at all. I really wasn't. But I think just by, like, staying true to the story and telling the truth, and also by not like resolving it or wrapping it up in a nice little message, and instead like sort of leaving the play in the space of, like, the unknown and the unknowable and the inarticulable, which is where that play ends up.
Absolutely.
I think it puts the responsibility in each audience's members, like, hands and minds to, like, go off and do with it what they will. And some people will reject it, and a lot of people did, and that's also okay. sometimes I want to be rejected as well.
And I think that's like the experience of your play. And I mean, like I said, like, as we know, it's a Pulitzer Prize finalist. A Strange Loop ended up winning the like Pulitzer for drama. But it was a finalist. Sorry, I'm juggling my cat right now. She's very excited to be back in the room. It was a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize in drama, which is, I've got it up so I can read it. Yeah, the Pulitzer Prize is an award for achievements in newspaper, magazine, and online journalism, literature, and musical composition. It's a big freaking deal. And I think the difference in how it resonated, how it was allowed to resonate, and also hearing how much, you know, thought went into it. We know how much thought has to go into craft and writing, but something like this really did require a very deft hand to allow people into this world while also feeling like they could take in different perspectives. And it's really interesting to hear that other people, younger people, resonated with Therese in a way that like disturbed them, because it would be disturbing. Therese is downright terrifying. She's scary as hell. Yeah. And yet that is not who she is and how she thinks, and that absolutism isn't only on one side, right? Like, it's not something that exists just in conservatism, and it's also not the only form of conservatism, which I think is what you explored really well. And for me, the other point of solace that like allowed me to access this work and think about it as more than just something I was afraid of was the way it doesn't let an audience off the hook, especially a white audience, is that you can't leave this piece and just think, wow, I just watched something. Like, you actually have to think about it and think about the ways that it connects with you and resonates with you and what you heard, and like how the different aspects of what you heard built on that. So congratulations to you for building such a thing, and I'm glad it was well received in the way that it was, and it took off in the way that it did.
Thank you. Yeah, me too. I'm glad too, because
a lot of terror went into it, I'm sure, but it all for the better. So I do, you know, I actually am really great that we got into Heroes, and I like secretly have wanted to have a dramaturgical conversation with someone about that, and to get to do that with you is even better. But I do want to talk about some of your other works that are out in the world. Plano is actually one of my favorites. That is the one play actually of yours that I did get to see like live and in person. Awesome. Let me lay down the synopsis of that, because Plano goes in like kind of a very different direction. It's about three sisters. It says, Isabel's got pains, Annie's got slugs, and Genevieve doesn't want to talk about hers. She just wants you to eat the damn hummus. She made it. Let's talk about family nightmares. We mean memories. And it really gets into like these three plagues that these sisters have. And it's a really, I think one of the like qualities of your writing that I've really stuck to and I've seen, and I'm not super, super familiar with like a lot of your work, but there's always this like quality where reality and realism is meeting something almost like fantastical in how that reality is presented. Is that intentional? Is that something you always wanted to do? Or is that kind of just how your pieces end up?
Yeah, it's sort of just how they end up. You know, I think that like, you know, obviously like Plano is much more fantastical than Heroes. Like a lot of like it's like there's so much going on. There's like a faceless ghost. There's a guy who's like doubled, and there's two of him. Mm-hmm. There's a slug infestation. There's like a man who keeps disappearing, and like time also just keeps like speeding up and slowing down in unpredictable ways, and there's just a lot going on. But I would say like when I was writing that play, I wasn't trying to be weird. I was just like I was just trying to tell the truth again about like what it was like to be the brother of these amazing women who were having these, who were sort of, being sort of plagued by the bad behavior of men, and sort of like wrestling with like, you know, my own manness, and sort of my own heartbreak at like sort of realizing like, what these men had done, especially men who like like one of whom I considered to be like a brother. Like I have seven sisters and despise only three of them, but like one of these men was like the closest thing I had to a brother. And then like for him to like hurt my sister so badly and also sort of like just change fundamentally, almost like become a different person, it almost felt like he had died. And so there was like a lot of grief at the heart of that. And like another sister of mine was going through a lot of like mysterious chronic illness. And and anyway, like I was just trying to tell the truth. And so much of like, I think the experience of being in a family, especially if you like, you know, like live in different places or, you know, have gone down different paths, is like time does speed up and slow down. And like you know, you may not see them for a while and then you see them again and it's like no time has passed, but also you're bringing all this new life into it and they catch up to that and they're also bringing their new you know, it's just like the experience of family and time sort of created this unique structure for the play that just felt true to me. So even though it was like absurd or whatever, it was like, it was grounded in a very, very like real pain. And just like there was no other way to like express this feeling than to like fuck with the theatrical form a little bit. And like, like it wouldn't make sense to just like have a scene where you like learn what's going on in this sister's life. It's like, no, you have to have like 20 scenes back to back over the course of like three pages, because that's how it felt to like receive all these updates about her life. Do you know what I mean?
Oh no, that makes so much sense, right? Like there's a very, I think like in itself, like a fantastical element to like catching up with family being in another place. And it, to have a large family too, like the more spread out you get, because then there are more of you across different places in the world, and it's just a different experience. I think in my own experience, there's a weird, and I'm really not very great at communicating with my family. I'm working on it. But when I lived away from them in New York, that was a really, I was the first person to A, move out of my parents' home, and I'm the youngest sibling, and B, I moved, and then I didn't even like move into, well, that's not true. My brother left for Florida. He left first. I don't have to take that. He left first. But it was a very different thing to like move to a whole new city, because I moved up to New York, and that's always, my dad's like always like really, he's not a big fan of big cities. He's like, you're gonna get lost up there. He's like, what's gonna go on? He's like, that's like a terrible place to move. And then to have to like go back and forth and being like, well, like now I'm home now, and like nothing has changed, nothing's really different, but also like here's all this stuff that's been happening. And they're like, well, what have you been doing while you're there? And I'm like, I don't know, working, like the same thing I do here, but I'm just doing it there. But it's like there's just a degree of separation, I think, between those two and how you explore telling people what's happened. And I think one of the hardest things is telling people like really big updates, right? Like news or like something that's gone wrong is one of the hardest things to actually talk about. And you don't know how to do that, especially if you're not physically with them when you have to tell them, because then it's like, well, there's a feeling of like, well, what can you do for me? And they're like, well, what can I do for you? I don't know. That's how I've experienced it.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And so much of Plano was born out of that feeling of feeling far away from these people that I love, especially when they're going through this. And and you wouldn't necessarily know that that's what the inspiration was when you actually experience Plano, because it's it's so alive in these sisters' lives, and like it's a real whirlwind of like activity, and it's very funny and it's very dark, and like then the mom shows up. I actually like there's like it's funny because I feel like Plano and Heroes are actually sort of like structured in a similar way. Like it is just sort of like we meet these people going through crisis, and then the older woman shows up and sort of like addresses it all.
Addresses crisis at large.
Yeah, but it, of course the plays feel very different. But But there's this moment in Plano where their mom shows up, and she's, and both of those characters, both the professor and Heroes and the mom in Plano, are based on my mom. And like, there's this moment where she shows up and she keeps talking about this tiny world that she and her husband have been building. They've been working on this tiny world, and the sisters want to see the tiny world, and she like shows it to them and slaps it shut. And then like later one of them steals it, and the play ends with them like looking into this tiny world that their mom has built. It's like in a box. And I like to joke when we were working on Heroes that Heroes was that tiny world. Like, and that, that's the little glimpse into what this matriarch is building, you know,
mm-hmm.
a sort of a more classic play, you know, a more Aristotelian
yeah.
play, unity of time, place, and action. And like,
it all comes back together.
Yeah. Yeah. That was fun to think about. But both of those plays do have elements of like ruptures in reality and like the unknown
yeah.
and the intrusion of the unknown into what we perceive as reality. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think like one of the things that, and I'll move us into our like personal section in a little bit, especially now that we've like opened the door to like the fact that you have seven sisters, which I think is insane. I've got one and that's enough. I love my sister very much. but one of the things that's like, you've mentioned it a couple times in both of these plays, and I think is part of just your writing in general, seems to be this aspect of truth and reality, right? But like there's, what you said about rupturing reality rings true even for like, you know, like our real life and not just like what we write in like creative worlds, is that like sometimes you do come across either truths or things you're exposed to or things you learn and find out that just sort of, they do break up the reality that you've been living in. They do disrupt where you think you were at or maybe where you think you were going. And there's like a moment of reckoning of like, well, how do I fit this, if I even can, into what I thought was my reality? Or like, do I need to like break down or restructure based
mm-hmm.
upon that? And I think your plays kind of give us some of those moments really well. And it's one of the talents of your work. It's great.
Thank you. Yeah.
No worries. Now, I would want to ask the cheesy questions of how you ended up in writing, but I honestly feel like I don't want to know. It's kind of a mystery. But I do want to know how you ended up in theater. Was that always, like, was theater always the plan? Or was it, did you come from, like, a different background?
Well, my dream, my first love was film.
Okay.
Yeah, my dream was always to one day make films. But I didn't really have access to, like, you know, I don't know, just theater felt more doable.
It's a little bit more in reach.
Yeah, and I, I was acting a lot, and then when I got to college, I continued acting, and I continued directing, and then my junior year of college, I finally took a playwriting course, and I just felt everything clicking. I'd been writing for a long time. And I was sort of like, consider myself maybe like a writer and an actor, but not like a playwright. And then my first experience of just like writing plays, I felt like an adrenaline and a sort of, yeah, like a clarity of purpose, and just everything converged on that in a really satisfying way. I mean, I think a lot of that had to do with growing up in such a big family and balancing all those perspectives in my head all the time, you know, just like being very comfortable with sort of opposing certainties, I guess, like, you know, which is something I experienced a lot in my household, like some very fiery personalities that just sort of like, you know, and being on the, because I was the second youngest. And so just absorbing all of that as a kid, like I felt almost like sponge-like, you know, I just like took it all in, and it was just like a part of me, the ability to just hear lots of different perspectives and not freak out or feel like I had to assert my own, really, because like,
yeah.
And that was sort of, yeah, that was a huge factor in what drew me to playwriting, and also just like, it felt very free somehow, but also extremely difficult. And I was drawn to both of those things, like the sort of limitlessness of the possibilities, because so much of it was sort of like dependent upon like the audience's imagination and sort of that like exchange between what was actually physically being offered and what was like existing sort of in the imaginative space, like around everyone or like above everyone's heads, or like, you know, like there's just like something magic that happens in theater and that's exciting. Like I love a challenge. And so that was sort
clearly.
Of
clearly. Yeah. If there's one thing I've taken away from today, it is that Will Arbery loves a challenge.
I do. What can I say? Yeah. I just like,
well,
I don't want to do it if I don't know how to do it. You know, I want to like find out how to do it. Doing it. Yeah.
That's good. I'm terrible at like doing things that I don't know how to do. I'll do them eventually, but it's like, ooh, I think I like to approach things with like a plan or like a strategy. So if it's something I completely don't know, I'm just like, well, let me do all of the things I can do. Let me like figure out what I need to know, and then I'll dive into it. I'm not always in the space of like, I don't know how to do it, but I'll just like jump into it anyway. That's it. Which is a strange way to be in theater. I think we find a lot of theater artists, at least I find, are just willing to be like, well, I don't know it, but I'm going to try it and see what happens.
Yeah. Yeah, totally.
But I do want to get into what I think is like my favorite thing is that your bio starts with the fact that you are from Texas plus Wyoming plus Seven Sisters. Are you willing to break down what it means to be from those three parts of like the world to us a little bit?
Yeah. I mean, I was actually born in New Hampshire. And we moved from there when I was seven. My parents hopped around from jobs. They were teaching at a tiny school, not unlike the one that they teach at Wyoming now, but that was in New Hampshire, and then they got an offer to teach at this sort of like almost like a think tank called the Dallas Institute of Humanities and Culture in Dallas, and so then we moved down there when I was seven, and those were my formative years. And then they moved to Wyoming to teach at the at Wyoming Catholic College, which is where they are now. And even though Texas was like most of my life, and does have a, you know, and obviously has like really influenced me. I mean, Plano takes place there, and I'm writing other stuff that takes place there. When they moved to Wyoming, I just felt. I felt something open up in me, or like something, it's hard to describe, but it's really sort of like that landscape and that the house where they are now and all of that. It just like, it felt like an encounter with the divine that like, I don't know. I just sort of instantly felt like this was meant to be. I write about that place all the time. It's a huge part of my imagination. When I'm there, I just feel like an expansiveness of soul that like felt very, very formative. So I actually didn't get to go there at all last year, which felt like I've just like my heart is longing for it. So I'm gonna go there this summer, and I just can't wait because I miss it a lot. But independent of place, I just really do feel like having Seven Sisters, I just wouldn't be who I am if it weren't for them. And so it feels like such an important thing to include because I just owe so much to them and I feel so, so fortunate to have been given, I don't know, just the opportunity to grow up surrounded by all these brilliant women.
Yeah, and I think you said you're the second to youngest, right? So six of those sisters are older than you, right? Yeah, I think there's something. I don't know what it's like to have a younger sibling, but I know as I get older, I move away from like being a very like sheltered younger sibling. Although I am still, you could probably ask my siblings and they would say that I am very still sheltered in a lot of ways. But there's a real experience of gratitude, I think, and especially to my older sister at that, of like how much of my personality has truly developed because of both of them. There is a joke among oldest siblings where it's just like your youngest sibling is really just like has stolen all of your personality. And it's a little bit true as I look at myself. But there's just like a lot of gratitude of like, oh, like who I am was built, you know, as much as it is by like parents who raise you, by the experience of like having older siblings who are looking out for you, but then also you are watching them and like the way that they grow up and the perspectives that they have and the way that they interact with the world that you may or may not take on, you may or may not like move away from, but it just leaves a resonance in how you move through the world and it changes like the perspectives that you see because you grow up outside of just yourself.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, I like if I mean, even in a very like direct way, like if I didn't have my sister Lucia, who's the second oldest and also an artist, like when I moved back home after college, and I moved back to Dallas, and I was just like, well, I don't know what I'm gonna do with my life. I guess like I like got trained to like sell knives in grocery stores, you know, and like those boot like I got trained for like a pyramid scheme basically to like
Oh my God.
and I like was at like going into these like depressing training sessions in like deep suburbia Dallas, like, and I was like supposedly gonna have this job, and I didn't even have a car, so I didn't know how I was gonna do it, and I was just like miserable, and Lucia was just basically like I had saved just enough money to like buy a plane ticket to New York and like put in a deposit on like a cheap apartment, and she was basically just like, go upstairs right now and buy your ticket to New York. You're moving to New York." And I was like, okay, and I did it. And like I'm so glad that I did, even though those first years in New York were really, really hard. Like I like if I didn't have an older sister who had like been through it and like knew that like you just have to like pursue your dreams, like I don't even know what I would be doing right now. Like I certainly didn't have that innately within myself. I mean, I think I have like a little bit of it, but like to have that mentorship, I mean, it was just like so important to me.
It's really crucial. No, my sister, that resonates with me so well because when I was looking at like going to New York, it was the only option that was out of state for me. It was the only like fellowship internship where I was like, okay, maybe I'll move for this. And then I got it and I was just like, oh, I would actually have to leave. That was like the experience of like, oh, I have to go somewhere and I wouldn't be home. And my sister was just like, well, she was just really supportive. I think she has always known how to toe the line with me of like knowing that I can use a push from time to time, but that I also need someone to say, if you go and you make mistakes, it will be okay, but you should still go and just make those mistakes. And that's always like the line that she's really held for me and still does. Yeah,
Absolutely.
that's, and it's so hard. Moving is such a hard thing.
It's so hard. It's I only now, like 10 years later, feel like I'm finally like, okay, I got this.
The way it takes time to like embrace a city is really, well, it's kind of like I think you mentioned about time earlier. Like, time is such a fickle thing where, you know, to go to New York City, it takes you 10 years to feel settled, and yet Wyoming is a place that like wasn't in your formative years, and yet that feels like a place that like really resonates with your soul and connects to you. And I think I don't know the math or science behind it, but there's just places that really connect and then places that are just really hard to get into. And there's no, you don't know which one it'll be.
Yeah, very true. And I still don't really feel that way about Texas. I mean, just because it was my formative years, that's also where I'm from. But even when I was there, I was like, this isn't right for me. Like, this isn't it. you know? Yeah. And yet, like, if it weren't for Lucia, I would have just, like, stayed there. Yeah.
I think that's such a funny thing. And I feel like I had, for a long time, New York was, like, the place that I wanted to go. And then I got there, and I was really happy there. And I did consider staying. And then I think one of the things that happened when I got back home to Maryland, and not just like home in PG County. I talk about PG County a lot. It's like, that is like the base of my soul. It is everything that I am. But being here in Maryland, I was able to reflect and be like, you know, I really like New York. It's a great city. It's a really specific city. But I think a lot of me was just happy there, but also like on edge to a place where I'm like, you know, I probably could go back there, but it would have to be for a limited amount of time. I don't think I could last there for that long, because you really, like, it's tough. It's tough as hell to like be in so much all the time. And as much as like you love a city, it just might not resonate with you. It might just not stick with you, where you're just like, yeah, this could really be home, no matter like how much time you spend there.
Yeah. It took a long time. And for me, like, I took a break to go to grad school at Northwestern, and and when I was there, I didn't know. I thought maybe I was just leaving New York. Like, maybe I would stay in Chicago. Who knows? But like, I found that when I was there, my heart was like reaching out for it again. I was like, you gotta go back. And I'm glad that I did. And I was surprised that it was that my heart was saying that, because I didn't. You know, it was hard as hell. Yeah.
Yeah. It doesn't feel like a place that you would reach back for. I think that was the most surprising, is that even though it was so hard and I like breathed a sigh of relief when I got home, I was like, oh, holy crap, I miss it. There's so much that I miss.
Yeah.
Now, I do want to ask, because I know you probably, I'm certain, spend so much time writing and probably reading too, but like, what are the things that, you know, make up the rest of your life? What are the things that you do beyond those two things? Especially because writing is like, you know, the thoughts just live in your brain all the time, no matter what.
I know. Sometimes I'm like, oh man, I really need to like get more hobbies.
It does feel like that, right? Like, you're just like, this is the only thing I do.
Yeah, it really does. It really does sometimes. I mean, I feel like what I do, I mean, I just will go to the mountains, you know, and I'll just like go hiking and you know, go upstate or go to Wyoming or something and just clear my head. I mean, that's just something that I love to do. I love to do that with friends and just go somewhere and be, and don't try to make do or any of that, you know. Yeah, and something I want to get better at too, because I can be a little bit of a workaholic, and like, and I think that I need to create more space in my life for just being. I've gotten better this year at like cooking and exercising and some of that stuff that maybe before I was just sort of like ignoring or just basically just like surviving, because making life for yourself in the theater is very, very difficult and can be really exhausting, especially if you're trying to make survival money on top of that, because you just doesn't pay enough or whatever. And like so there was like a whole decade of my life where I was just working and wearing myself out, and now I'm learning that I do have a little bit more space to just do the beautiful being things in life I'm slowly building that capacity.
I think it takes like a long time as an artist too, where, or even as a person, where you've been in survival mode for so long, and you've been working off of either limited time or limited money or both, and then you kind of, even when those things start to, like, you end up with more time or you end up with more money, you're still in that mode because you've been in it for so long that you're like, oh, I actually can do this thing now. I can take more time here than I used to. I can afford the luxury of being in a way that I didn't used to. That even when you know it, it takes a while to really implement it. And then when you implement it, you're like, what do I do with it?
Yeah.
And how do I embrace it when I haven't for so long?
Yeah. Yeah, it's so important. Yeah.
No, it's really tricky. I think one of the things, hiking is so funny to me because my sister just texted me and she was like, we should go hiking more often. And I was like, okay, we can do that. And she was like, let's go on a 2-day trip. And I'm like, I'm pretty sure that's not how that works when neither of us have ever really done hiking in the first place. And I know it is just walking, but like, that's like 2 days outside. I don't know how to do that. Do you know how to do that? And she's like, let's just do it. And this goes back to the thing where I'm like, no, we need to know a little bit more first. But, and I wonder if this is just like a reaction to the pandemic, because it's probably not. But I think one of the things when we ask people about like what they're interested in, where are they putting their energy and their time now, outside is the answer we get a lot. Mm-hmm. Like whether it's just like walks outside or like going to expansive places like Wyoming and like actually like camping and things like that. It's just, there's just this common thread of people who are just like, I just want to spend more time outside. And I'm just interested in like how that has come to be for so many people. But also it's like, even if you don't like the outdoors for like weather or bugs or all of those things, there's still something about it that at some point you just really need fresh air. You just need it.
Yeah. Yeah, totally. Like right now, it's terrible with the pollen outside. I'm so allergic to pollen. But I feel like, oh my gosh, I can't just stay cooped up like this. So I'm like, after this podcast, I'm like going to do some errands outside. And I'm like, you know, I'm going to wear a mask. I'm going to wear a hat so the pollen doesn't get in my hair. And I'm like, I can't hide from the sunshine like this. This is terrible.
Yeah. You're just like, I gotta go be outside and be a person for a little bit.
Yeah, even if it hurts. Yeah.
The pollen is really strong this year. It's really bad. I live right next to like this huge oak tree, and my roommate and I always know when it's spring because she works at the window right outside of it. And every, like once it starts to be spring, her like amount of sneezes every morning just like increases.
Yeah.
Like exponentially. It's really great. It's like every year we know.
Yeah.
Well, we will let you get back to the outside world as soon as we can. But before we do, as much fun as this has been, I really want to let you talk about your foundation that you brought to us, of your choosing. And that is Creativity Explored, which is really, really cool. But I want you to let us know a little bit about that and why you brought them to us today.
Yeah. So part of my interest in Creativity Explored, which is a organization in California that that basically, you know, supports artists with developmental disabilities of all kinds, you know, just all sorts of neurodivergence. But they, you know, have workshops and exhibitions and classes, all sorts of things, and just some amazing work comes out of it. And I found out about it through, there's an artist named Michael Bernard Loggins, and actually these books that he published, one of which is called Fears for Your Life, which is just like a book of like illustrations and writings that he did of like different things that he's afraid of, and it's like so beautiful. And then another one that I actually have right here called Imaginationally, which is like all these like made up words that he makes.
That
he gives like definitions and drawings for, like life surprise, horroriest, home marker, knowledgement, laughterful, snubbled. I don't know. Like it's just like
this is so amazing.
So amazing and so terrific. And part of my interest in this kind of work is I have a sister who has Down syndrome, and I'm writing a play about her called Corsicana, and she's just been like a huge inspiration to me, especially like the way that she uses language and the ways that she's creative, and I love collaborating with her, and it sort of opened up for me a wider interest in like outsider art or self-taught art. Yeah, and they're basically like, you know, Creativity Explored is just one of like many local centers or organizations. Like you can find them in almost any city. Like Chicago has Intuit Art Center. There's a gallery in Waxahachie, Texas called Web Art Gallery, where I buy, I've started buying a lot of pieces by these artists, and yeah, I don't know. It's just like really, it's there's just like a whole world of like beautiful, beautiful expression by some amazing people who whose talents need to be nurtured, because there's just, yeah, I get emotional thinking about it, like just how that creativity comes out despite you know, circumstances that might not be amenable to it, or like a capitalistic like culture that is very, you know, where art is just like consumed and like overpriced, and sort of it becomes this sort of like this whole other thing that is like so like gross and oddly removed from like that purity of expression. And anyway, so that's why I like Creativity Explored, and yeah.
We're really glad you brought them to us, and I think everything you said is one of the things that really resonated with me when I like explored their website. I mean, they're a San Francisco-based collective, and you know, we're Greatest City Collective. We love to hear that, and it's really amazing how much ownership and empowerment goes into like the artists that they're working with, and that you know, they put up these exhibitions. You can go see the work that they've done. They're doing virtual classes to bring other people who might have a creative inclination that are also neurodivergent into the world of like artistry and like really building a craft and an ability to hold that. But then also, you know, you can purchase this art. Like it's art, yeah, for the sake of art, but it's also, you know, they're like, hey, like here's what people are building. So you can see it, you can look at it. And if it resonates with you, you can also buy it. I mean, there's so many cool t-shirts and like wall arts that you can put up, so many cool prints and patterns and like pottery and so much amazing stuff that was given to us and like to the world through this organization. So I'm really grateful for you to bring, for you for bringing that to our attention, Will.
Yeah, no problem.
Thank you. And one of the really cool things is that you can also donate to support the classes and the things that they're doing to support these artists. But if you want to support the artists directly, you can go buy something really cool, yes, for yourself, and you'll know where you got it from because they feature the artist who made it and like a little bit of information about how it was made. So it's, yes, super, super cool in a lot of different ways.
Yeah, so cool.
Thank you. So thank you, Will, for joining us today. You were so amazing to have. Thank you for diving in so deep about your work and then also about your personal life. And for just being amazing. Thank you.
Thank you for being amazing. This was such a fun conversation.
It was really great. And I am excited to say that next week we will be moving in a completely other direction to talk about fashion and brand creation with fashion designer and creator of Love Olu line, Fasayo Quadri. She's also a Flowers alum, same here with me, and a PG County native. So great, great fun will be had in that conversation. And I can't wait to share it with y'all. But for now, thank you for listening. And Will, thank you again for joining us.